All right, let's see. In the news, well, this is something that I've wanted to talk about, actually, and there's a good reason to talk about it because it's in the news. And I'll just start right off with the story here. Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007 introduced in Congress. This is a story from February 14th, so a week or so ago. And I'll just read a snip from it here, and then I'll riff a little bit on it. For the second time since the federal government outlawed hemp farming in the United States, a federal bill has been introduced that would remove restrictions on the cultivation of non-psychoactive industrial hemp. The chief sponsor of H.R. 1009, the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007, is Representative Ron Paul, who, by the way, is also a candidate for president in the upcoming election in 2008. And there are a number of other co-sponsors to the bill. All right. Here's a quote from Dr. Paul. It is indefensible that the United States government prevents American farmers from growing this crop. The prohibition subsidizes farmers in countries from Canada to Romania by eliminating American competition and encourages jobs in industries such as food, auto parts, and clothing that utilize industrial hemp to be located overseas instead of in the United States, said Dr. Paul. By passing the Industrial Hemp Farming Act, the House of Representatives can help American farmers reduce the trade deficit, and do it all without spending a single taxpayer dollar. Now, of course, the article goes on to a greater extent than that, and if you're interested in this, you can go just do a search on the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007, and you can learn a little bit about it. And in the meantime, you should learn a little bit about the history of this particular plant, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it right now, I guess, because I've had a lot of questions that have come in email lately, both locally and also from listeners who are listening outside of the state, but a lot of stuff locally lately because people are tuning into this. So anyway, there have been a lot of questions about hemp, about marijuana, and about psychedelics. So before, well, let me relate something to begin this whole thing, all right? Let me relate something to you that has sort of gotten me upset. I've maintained for a long time that anyone unwilling to discuss hemp as an agricultural gold mine and an environmental godsend is a person who can be pretty much shown as ignorant or disingenuous. So here's a little bit of a story for y'all, all right? And this is especially for the progressive-minded people here in mid-Missouri. Okay, there is all this talk of sustainability, and it prompted me to address the hemp issue with both of our local newspapers. And I'm going to read to you the letter that I sent to both the Columbia Tribune and to the Missourian about 3 weeks ago, over 3 weeks ago, as a matter of fact. All right. And here's the letter. Okay. It goes just like this. There is much talk these days in Columbia and the mid-Missouri region about sustainability and how we might all work together toward a more reasonable, healthy, and green future. I've attended a number of the meetings and talked to a whole lot of people, and so far I've not heard anyone mention the benefits of the reintroduction of industrial hemp into the local and regional economy. I see zero reasons why this simple step could not have an immediate and positive impact on the local, regional, and state economies, as well as all of the concerns of sustainability and environmentally minded people. Anyone not willing to discuss the reintroduction of industrial hemp into the Missouri economy is not truly serious about these concerns. How are we to take seriously those who ignore and reject a single most beneficial solution to a whole host of environmental and energy issues? Food, fuel, textiles, animal fodder, soil rejuvenation, all from one plant that can be grown anywhere in this state without pesticides, and without fertilizers, hemp. If people were serious about the severity of the crisis we are facing, only psychosis could explain such an obvious ignorance of solution. Rejecting the realities of the hemp plant is no longer an excuse. This is a big-time corrective measure that can be implemented essentially overnight, and it is something that everyone who is sincere about sustainable community and a green future should be able to agree upon. How about it? Is this community progressive enough to consider the wisdom of the world's oldest cultivated plant and one that could really truly help us? And if not, for God's sake, why? All right. So that's the end of my letter, signed, of course, me, Mike Hagan. And it went out to both newspapers here, the Columbia Tribune and the Columbia Missourian. And guess what? Now, this is before the Hemp Act news came out, although maybe I was privy to information beforehand. Regardless, this is 3 or 4 weeks ago I sent this letter. And guess what? Nothing. No response. It wasn't published. And in fact, I didn't even get the courtesy of a reply from anyone at either of the papers. Not even an FU reply, you know, the auto reply, the thing that you come, that, you know, that the machine sends back to you, you know. And I don't dig being ignored like anybody. So I guess I want to put a question out there to all the journalists in town. And the question is this: are you willing to research, investigate, and report on the hemp story in a credible, unbiased, and courageous fashion? That's my question. I mean, come on. Where's the hardcore journalism in this town? Where's all the forward-thinking, creative, inquisitive journalism professionals on this subject? Where's the deep digging, the investigative reporting here at Mizzou on sustainability, Gaian theory, viable fuel alternatives, these sorts of things? Very little of it. Something other than what's being pushed by the usual suspects and their lobbies. We have a celebrated journalism school here in Mizzou, right? I challenge all of you to investigate the hemp story, the entire story, you know, the history of it, everything, and start to report on it honestly. We need journalists that will begin to do investigative reporting again and not do news by press release. We have enough news by press release. It's called oil-soaked lapdog journalism. And it's not the young people's fault who are going into these fields. They're essentially innocent and believe what's being taught to them. I wonder how much the average journalism student knows about the history of newspapers. Do they know who William Randolph Hearst was? Do they teach you about him at the vaunted Mizzou School of Journalism? Let me tell you a little bit about William Randolph Hearst if they don't teach you about him. He was essentially a newspaper tycoon who was also in the pulp business. So essentially, he made a boatload of cash cutting down trees, turning them into paper, and then printing his own propaganda on the paper and selling it to the public as news. Sound familiar? But anyway, he's a scumbag, all right? And I'm not the only one that recognizes this. You know, there was a book, I don't know, 15 years ago, plus or minus. It was called Unreliable Sources. It was written by a guy named Martin Lee with a partner. I forget his partner's name. But anyway, Martin Lee wrote a book called Unreliable Sources. And he talked about how William Randolph Hearst routinely invented sensational stories and faked interviews and ran phony pictures and distorted real events and was one of the pioneers in the use of what eventually became known as yellow journalism. He ran this one paper called the New York Journal, and he would use these techniques to whip up popular support for things like U.S. military adventurism in Cuba, in the Philippines, in Puerto Rico. This is in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. There's another great author named Upton Sinclair who wrote a book called The Brass Check. Here's another one for all you journalism students. The Brass Check. It's called A Study of American Journalism. And Upton Sinclair talked about William Hearst again and about how he and his employees were willing to do anything, essentially, to make up shameful lies made up of whole cloth to stir nations to enmity and drive them to war. Of course, the same strategy was used to spread propaganda relentlessly about the plant, the cannabis plant. Use his own papers to spread propaganda about this whole business. And we've been living it for 70 years. So William Randolph Hearst and the DuPont family, another familiar name, another American icon, along with a few other influential cohorts, were primarily responsible for this ramrodding through Congress of the Marijuana Tax Act, which was passed in 1937. And the reasoning behind this bill that was completely, it was virtually illegally put through Congress anyway, but that's not the first time that's happened. Look at the Federal Reserve Act. At any rate, the reason had nothing to do with moral or health-related issues, had nothing to do with anything like this. They were trying to prevent the growth of a new industry so that they wouldn't go bankrupt, so that they wouldn't go broke. It was essentially a turf war and a profit issue. And hemp threatened William Randolph Hearst's pulp business. And to this day, hemp is included in the same witch hunt for its detrimental effects, not on human biology, but for its detrimental effects on the gigantic profits of every wood pulp and petrochemical-based industry on this planet. And we basically have William Randolph Hearst and his greedy sociopath freak contemporaries to thank for that. This is the same bunch, by the way, who promoted the slang term marijuana, with the idea being to equate cannabis, which was the term that had been familiar and goes back, eons, and can be traced back into every religion on this planet that these people are touting. But the idea was to equate cannabis with, you know, those unclean, brown-skinned, subhuman folks south of the border, and covertly influence mainstream white-bread America to take a very dim view of this substance and the plant. And 70-odd years later, you know, it looks like the tactic worked pretty well. But, you know, nothing lasts forever. And the cat's out of the sack, okay? So with that in mind, I would implore all of you to, first of all, consciously use the word cannabis instead of the word marijuana when conversing on the subject. You know, it's no wonder I can't get a letter published about this stuff in the papers. Most of the papers, and by association their staffs, they still carry this twisted tradition that they don't even know they're a part of. And in that tradition, there are certain things that are taboo. The hemp cannabis story is one of those taboos. 100 years ago, this was a huge and growing part of a sustainable economy. Today, it is maligned, misunderstood. It is the target of a ruthless propaganda campaign that has gone on for decades and is constantly under genocidal attack. As a species, you see? As a species. What gives anyone the right to determine which species are allowed to continue and which are not? Genocide is genocide. Animal or plant or idea. It's just remarkable. How progressive of us. Anyway, I'm looking at my email here, and I have a question here. And again, the question regards, the reason I'm reading it is because it's obviously the guy's listening or whatever, or the girl. And it says, regarding hemp, marijuana, and psychedelics, is it purely a financial issue in which the powers that be want to keep a handle on the dollars generated by the products, or is it also an ideological, philosophical repression? Well, whoever asked this is a smart person, first of all, because they recognized that Hearst and his ilk, they could have jumped on the bandwagon. They could have jumped on the hemp bandwagon and made just as much money on hemp as they were making chopping down trees or cotton or whatever. So why did they opt for criminalization? It's interesting because nowhere is the contradiction in economic logic more clear than in this case of cannabis and hemp. And I'll get back to that in just a second, but let me riff on something else first since they bring it up. You know, it sort of simplifies the issue to say that it's entirely a money thing because psychedelics are used by such a small percentage of the population that they don't rate with the tremendous institutional rage and fury that they evoke from you know, the powers that be. In other words, there isn't a whole lot of money being made by anyone in the psychedelic community. There never has been. So why is there such an unbalanced and vicious response to these particular substances? You see, the subtext behind the government and institutionalized fear of psychedelics, I think, is that this quality of the visionary plants, and you know me, I only talk about the plants. I'm not into the synthetics. Let other people talk about that. But this quality of the visionary plants to dissolve boundaries causes people to question basic assumptions about how society works and how it is run. The experiences that people have when they do these things are so powerful and so profound that it causes them to make a reassessment of their worldview, simply because the lens that they are viewing the world through just opened way up. So this is threatening to the ruling power structure. And I think this is true of any society. I mean, it isn't just an American phenomenon, because it doesn't matter if you're a red Chinese Marxist or a libertarian quality control technician from Hicktown, Missouri. When you ingest one of these substances, psilocybin, for example, in the right set, in the right setting, whatever you are, you know, quantum physicist, Catholic priest, indigenous tribesman, you will question your first premises. You will question your primary beliefs. And when you get millions of people questioning their first premises, questioning their primary beliefs, governments and other institutions with agendas of power and control, they get very nervous. I find it really interesting that, and ironic actually, that the whole phenomenon of the 1960s occurred because of the American commitment to universal public education. And that commitment was just bringing its first generation of children to adulthood in the 60s, because that universal commitment to education began just after World War II. And after the people at top levels of establishment actually got a look at what this meant, the building and funding of great public universities and filling them with inquisitive and creative young minds, when they saw what the result of that was, well, that's when they decided to turn the universities back into trade schools for certified public accountants and the coveteers of MBAs and this sort of people, you know, which they did in fact do. I mean, there's nothing of the sort of thing that was being encouraged of students back in the 1960s and the early 70s. Nothing of the sort of education and intellectual curiosity that was going on back then. None of that is still in place. That's all finished now. Now what we expect of college graduates is, you know, you're expected to do your data entry job without reproach or question. You're expected to watch a boatload of television, which is a powerful drug in and of itself. And you're expected to keep your mouth shut. That's basically what we expect of college grads these days. See, essentially, there was a crisis of faith in American institutions back in the 1960s. And this was only made, it was intensified by psychedelics. In other words, it was a combination of educating people in large numbers for the first time. You know, not indoctrinating people or conditioning people, but it was actually a combination of educating people in large numbers for the first time to the actual traditions and history of Western civilization, and then giving them access to psychedelics. And people began to ask questions for which there were no answers. And the response of the establishment was and is suppression and repression. A most brutal repression, as a matter of fact. Just look at who's in jail and how many of them. Now, the question of cannabis is what got me started on this thread. And many of you are familiar thanks to the work of those in the hemp community for many years, that cannabis presents many positive benefits, not necessarily related to its properties as an intoxicant, but as a source of food, fuel, lubricants, plastics, clothing, paper. And the real reason that the powers that be are so hysterical on the subject of cannabis is because its use erodes loyalty to the values of the industrial state. It erodes faith in the ideas, the ideals, and the pillars of consumer capitalism. I mean, that's why. I mean, come on. Let's look at the pharmacology of a couple of familiar drugs to make the comparison, all right? Let's look, number one, at caffeine. We all know what that one is, right? Well, we have the medical data, too. And we know that it can cause fetal malformation. We know it damages the liver. We know it damages the kidneys, the stomach. We know these things. Now, cannabis, number two in our comparison here, and by the way, vast amounts of money have been spent trying to find something wrong with this stuff, and they're still digging, folks. I mean, they've determined that, you know, it doesn't cause tits to grow on statues and all the other ridiculous stuff that they've tried to push about this plant. All of that stuff has had to be abandoned. And now the only way those arguments stand is next to ignorance. Anyone who does their homework knows what's really going on now. So why is caffeine enshrined then into the contracts of every labor negotiation in the Western world as a sacred right of all workers to dose up twice a day? Why is that? And why then with cannabis can you lose your job, your home, your car, your music collection, your children, simply because you had a few plants growing in the back 40? Why the disparity? I'll tell you why. Let's look at what these two drugs do. What is the effect of caffeine? Well, with regard to labor contracts, it allows a worker to perform as productively during the last few hours of work as he does during the first few hours of work. It allows people to tolerate spinning out worthless widgets until hell freezes over without ever having the thought enter their mind that this might be a ridiculous way to spend their life. Cannabis, now, on the other hand, sure, people aren't very interested in going to work. They don't want to go make widgets. There's a difference, my friends, between that and laziness, okay? But they're not interested in making widgets, perhaps. They'd rather stay home and make love or make art. And they don't want to watch brain-dead television. They'd rather twist a bomber and have a conversation with a friend. In other words, these things promote activities that, number one, don't make anyone any money, and number two, cause people to question the institutions and the social philosophies that are being jammed down their throats. On a level playing field, I think, caffeine might well be a prescription drug. Maybe that's not even a good idea, but it might well be. And cannabis might be freely available. The most dangerous drugs in our culture, in terms of their detrimental social effects, are alcohol and tobacco. The two most freely available, peddled on every street corner, every city. And I'd add television to the list. But, you know, the argument I made with regard to caffeine can easily be modified to apply to these other socially condoned drugs, alcohol, tobacco, sugar. So we have this cracked brain approach to substances and the problem of drugs. Even though we're not the only society, all societies seem to do this. I mean, out of a possible spectrum of, I don't know, maybe 30 or so depressants and intoxicants, most cultures pick 3 or 4 that they hail as harmless and put up on a pedestal. And the rest of them, the spawn of Lucifer. And then this attitude is persevered with and propped up against all scientific evidence, against all medical research. It's just what people choose to believe. The problem is that we don't have the luxury anymore to keep up with this type of ignorance. We no longer can afford to embrace, you know, culture-bound, provincial, and hick-like attitude that ignores solutions because of propaganda and boneheaded politics. The amount of revenue that could be provided by a cannabis economy, the pressure that could be taken off of petroleum use, petroleum extraction, so many other things, and they're all out there. All of these things can be improved greatly if cannabis were a part of the picture. All of these things make it incumbent upon us, make it our responsibility to think more creatively and more honestly about which drugs are really posing problems for us in this culture and this society. I've said it before, the situation we find ourselves in, the cultural crisis that we are fast approaching, if not in the middle of, is not a situation in which we need to find the answers. It is a situation in which we need to face the answers. So how about a starting point? All right? We've got a bill introduced in Congress by a Republican, all right, that gives you, all of you, Democrats, Republicans, Christians, Jews, I don't care what you are, it gives you the opportunity to embrace this thing without feeling silly, all right? And there's no reason to feel silly about it. Your ancestors, you know, had a great symbiotic relationship with this plant. We've just been fed, you know, a huge pottage. You know, we've been fed a line, and it's time to change things. So to get the ball rolling, and it's a good idea that is not my own, it starts like this. It starts by recognizing as legitimate that which we have denied for so long. Let us declare nature as legitimate. Let us declare all plants and all animals, for that matter, as legitimate and legal. The notion of an illegal plant or an illegal animal is obnoxious and preposterous as you being illegal or illegitimate. Nature does not create illegitimacy. So let's start there. All plants and all animals, legal and legitimate. And please, let's start to talk about this more in our community. It's time. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.